We're talking about a large number of apparent overdose deaths in Milwaukee. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Milwaukee authorities responded to 14 deaths in recent days that appeared to be overdoses. Three people died Sunday in the span of 1 hour. What questions do you have about overdoses and how authorities respond to them? How do you think authorities should be addressing overdose deaths? Are there enough resources in your community? Join in 800-642-1234. Sarah Schreiber is the Milwaukee County Medical Examiner's Technical Forensic Director. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you.
So what do we know this morning about these 14 deaths?
We know that we responded to 14 probable overdose cases during the course of Friday through yesterday morning. The autopsies have taken place either yesterday or this morning related to these cases, so we don't have any particular causes of death as the toxicology has not been completed yet in these cases.
So do we have any idea then what drugs or substances might be involved here?
We don't yet have specific information as toxicology is not complete. What we have from scene investigation and interviews with family and friends, though, leads us to believe that some of the cases, the individuals had a history of heroin use, some had a history of prescription drug misuse, some had a cocaine misuse history, and others didn't really have much to say from family and friends. Scenes spoke otherwise in some cases where we found paraphernalia or potential drug residue. In other cases, there were prescription medications on scene that maybe contributed to their cause of death. Until toxicology is complete, though, we won't be able to answer that question completely.
What can you tell us about the people who have died? Were there any of them related to each other? Were any of these deaths connected?
Only one incident seems to be connected. There were two individuals found in one location, but all of the rest of the individuals were found just as individuals scattered throughout the city and the county.
So what is happening in the office's investigation of these cases? You get toxicology results back. What are next steps?
After toxicology has been completed, those results are given to the forensic pathologists, the medical examiners, and they will review those findings in light of the other findings they have from autopsy, medical records review, and the medical investigative review that our medical legal death investigators conduct over the course of this death investigation, put all that information together before ruling on cause and manner of death.
Would you normally do autopsies on all of these types of cases?
Yes. This is very routine.
We're talking about a spike in deadly overdoses, perhaps, with Sarah Schreiber. She's a forensic scientist at the Milwaukee County Medical Examiner's Office. What questions do you have about overdoses and how authorities respond? What do you think authorities should do differently? Have you lost a friend or family member to an overdose? How did you handle that difficult situation? What resources would you recommend? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah, records from the medical examiner show Milwaukee has seen 450 drug deaths so far this year. How often does Milwaukee see a spike of fatal overdoses, perhaps like this?
We see ebbs and flows in these kinds of cases, especially as it relates to weekends. That seems to be where we see the most impact of things as those cases collect for Monday mornings. The last spike we saw that comes to mind was in early June, and we had seven individuals that were potential cases over one weekend, so, you know, over that three-day time span. 14 this past weekend is definitely an increase from that, and the frequency of those calls came in very quickly in time to each other, making us very concerned about the resources to put forth to do those investigations and respond to those scenes.
Is it unusual to see overdoses so close together anywhere in the state, clustered?
Geographically or in time?
Geographically.
No, that's not uncommon at all. Okay. Anywhere people are pooled together, those kinds of things can happen. Individuals use with different frequency and different habits. So some use together, some like to use in isolation or alone. Their preferences vary very greatly. So sometimes we can find, you know, individuals all alone, and sometimes we find them paired up. Usually not large numbers together, but it wouldn't be uncommon.
Milwaukee being the state's largest county, so it would have a big impact on statewide overdose numbers. Has Milwaukee County been experiencing more overdoses when you look across the years, in recent years?
Definitely. Our numbers have increased steadily. Going back to 2011, we had 180 total drug deaths attributed that year. In 2017, we had 401. We were down slightly last year with 384 and have currently signed out 166 this year to date as probable or as confirmed drug-related deaths.
So tracking a lot like what you've been seeing in the past.
Definitely.
Well, let's take a call now. Arthur joining us from Jefferson. Hi, Arthur.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is about this group of overdose deaths that happened in Milwaukee over the weekend. I'm from Jefferson County. I know of at least three heroin overdose deaths that happened over the weekend. I'm just wondering if it's possible to use information like this to trace the spread of drugs from the city out into rural areas, and also if it's possible to trace what might be one bad batch of drugs back to its source. I can take my comments off the air.
Thank you, Arthur. Yes, Sarah, go ahead.
Hi. Yes, thank you for the call. It is possible to track those things. That's the work that law enforcement does, though. The information that we can help support out of the death investigations that we do, supporting that toxicology information to tell them what was in the individual at the time that they died, can help them link those things back together as they do the investigation into who was the supplier and who ultimately was the dealer in that drug trafficking line. It's difficult to say particularly that the particular drug found in an individual definitely came from this line, but when law enforcement gets involved, they can make undercover buys and they can do other investigative leads to bring themselves closer to that information as whether or not we have the same source from the same dealer or the same supplier.
Can you say anything about new state laws affecting how Wisconsin approaches the opioid crisis, and specifically with how readily available naloxone is?
I can't speak specifically to the laws. Naloxone has become very available to individuals, which has certainly cut down on the number of overdoses in certain areas. The statistics on the distribution of naloxone and the use of Narcan in medical treatment initiatives has certainly gone way up and has unremarkably, without a cause, saved many, many lives. I think the more staggering statistic from this weekend is probably how many lives were saved because of those measures.
We've been talking for years now about the opioid crisis and more recently about problems with fentanyl and methamphetamine. Are you seeing any new or growing patterns with overdoses in Milwaukee County?
The greater pattern is probably with relation to cocaine. We've seen a great increase in cocaine cases in the last couple of years. And most of those overdoses have been in conjunction with another opioid. So some contained fentanyl, some contained another opioid or a prescription opioid. We have not seen a tremendous increase in methamphetamine cases, although we are keeping a pulse on that. In the years prior to 2017, we saw one or maybe zero cases that related to methamphetamine. And in 2017 and 2018, we had 11 cases each year that contained methamphetamine. While those numbers don't rival what we're seeing with the opioid epidemic, they certainly are an increase in statistic and something to keep an eye on as folks move toward those stimulant drugs.
Sarah, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you this morning.
Sarah Schreiber is Milwaukee County Medical Examiner's Technical Forensic Director. Up next, we talk about electric scooters that are now legal in Wisconsin and the politics of our shared roadways. What questions do you have about electric scooters? What do you think about sharing the road with them? Your questions welcome, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about sidewalks and streets, how we get from point A to point B. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Cities around the world are changing. They're becoming more walkable, and improving a city's walkability can ease traffic flow. It can improve public health. Big upsides there. But recently, we've heard about these thorny issues involving electric scooters and pedestrians. who has the right over the sidewalk? Electric scooters are now legal here in Wisconsin, but there's still confusion about where they can go and where they belong. And there's a bigger question over how we share our sidewalks and roads equitably. Do you ride electric scooters to get around? Were they helpful when you're visiting a new city? Or do you think that they're more of a danger than a practical form of transportation? Join in, 800-642-1234. Peter Norton is an associate professor of history in the Department of Engineering and Society at the University of Virginia. He wrote a book called Fighting Traffic, The Dawn of the Motor Age in the American City. Peter, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate.
So starting with these scooters, to people who've never been on one or who don't really understand how they work, what does this form of transportation offer people that bikes or cars or even our 2 feet can't offer?
Well, it's a really new thing because you may just be strolling along and you might find a scooter on a sidewalk, or if you use your phone and you have an app, you might locate one. And you can just pick it up, connect with it through your phone, and be on your way. So if you have the phone and you have the app, it's got a real inviting ease of use about it. You don't have to wait for somebody to pick you up. You're not at a bus stop. You can be quite impulsive about it. You don't have a schedule to pay attention to. And you don't have, say, a driver to negotiate a trip with. So there's a real convenience and fun value to them.
There sounds like there's some freedom there that you're referring to. How fast can they go?
Well, you can go up to 20 miles an hour. You'll feel the difference if there's a slope. You can't go fast uphill, and you'll go faster downhill. Some cities want to limit them to 15 miles an hour maximum. But that feels pretty fast when you're standing on a little platform fully exposed. It sounds very slow if you're driving, but it can be almost exhilarating when you're just standing on a little platform.
Well, we've seen some pictures of them in dumpsters, strewn on streets, on fire in some cities. How has this become part of scooters? What is the downside here?
Yeah, well, I mean, so far, everything I've said makes them sound like, a very attractive thing, but they're very controversial and for good reasons. So for one thing, they don't really feel like they're for everybody. At least that's a perspective about them. For example, you need the phone and you need the app. And then they compete for space. It's not really clear where they do or even should fit in. So most cities want to keep them on the street, but some have actually required them to stay on the sidewalk. And they're not really ideal for either, because if you're in the street and cars are going a lot faster and they're not used to watching out for scooters, that can feel scary if you're on the scooter. And it can feel annoying if you're a driver and you're not sure what to expect. But then if this scooter rider goes on the sidewalk, well, now they're scooting around people who are walking, which can feel threatening or even be dangerous if you're walking. Maybe the worst part is when you're done, you don't have to take the scooter anywhere. You just stop using it. They lock automatically when you've stopped using it. And then that can get in people's way, which can be a nuisance if you're mobile, but it can be much worse if you're in a wheelchair or have some other disability that makes it difficult to get around a discarded scooter. So they can be a real nuisance, and they can be, of course, therefore really resented. And I think the kinds of incidents you were talking about there really illustrate that resentment.
We're talking about sharing the road, the tension, and how we get around our communities. Peter Norton is an associate professor of history in the Department of Engineering and Society at the University of Virginia. Do you ride electric scooters to get around town? Were they a help when you were visiting a new city, or do you think they're more of a danger than a practical form of transportation? Join in with your questions, your observations, your stories, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Peter Norton, take us way back in time, like 100 years ago. And from a historical standpoint, where did we see scooters? How did they evolve?
Well, I think that's a great question because there is a history to this, and it really helps explain why we are where we are right now with scooters not really having a place. Well, there was nothing really quite like scooters 100 years ago, but there were similar competitions and similar questions about what streets are for, who belongs in them, and who doesn't. And those battles have never really gone away. They're just reviving right now thanks to scooters. Scooters remind me a lot of what happened when bicycles first became common. If you read the letters to the editor and the editorial columns and the news columns of the newspapers of the day, it almost sounds like they were talking about scooters. They're resented. They feel like they weren't for everybody because bicycles were pretty expensive originally. It wasn't clear where they were supposed to go. When they went on the sidewalks, the pedestrians felt like they were endangered by them. And when they went in the streets, well, then they were getting in the way of the traffic that claimed to have a more legitimate right to the street. And there's the same kind of resentments, the same kinds of name-calling, the same kinds of anger on all sides of the issue. Now, I think that a really important development comes when automobiles come along, because they too enter into this competition. But what happened with automobiles is the people who wanted to sell them were very smart about finding ways to make sure that streets prioritized cars and motor vehicles, which they didn't originally do. And so by the 1920s, they had, through a lot of heavy-duty local, state, and national lobbying, managed to get priority in city streets. And I think that helps explain where we are today, because really the scooter might be an ideal street vehicle, especially downtown, where the vehicles are slower and where the destinations are closer together. But we have laws and engineering that favors automobiles, and the scooter riders feel that, and therefore they don't really feel that welcome on the street. They feel, a lot of them feel like it's kind of a dangerous place to be on a scooter. So then they feel like, well, then I need to get up on the sidewalk. And then, of course, they find out that that's going to be resented as well. And that's how we are where we are today, that sort of intense struggle. It's like the scooter riders and the pedestrians are competing over the crumbs that are left over because the automobile has really come first to the banquet and helped itself.
Is there anything to a younger population riding scooters with perhaps a higher degree of tech savviness? And
oh, yeah. What? Yeah, that's a big part of it. One of the first cities to have scooters, and it wasn't the city's decision, it was the scooter company's decision, was San Francisco. And there was already some really bad feeling between the techies, sometimes called the tech bros, young, affluent people who worked for Google or other tech companies that were driving up the rents, gentrification, making the city too expensive to live in. And so there was some really strong resentment before the first scooter appeared. And then the scooters start appearing, and they're not that welcoming to everybody in the sense that it takes a certain tech savviness and also a smartphone to use one. And the population that actually did use them tended to be that same tech crowd. And they're not necessarily the cheapest way to get around either. They're more expensive typically than a bus trip of the same length. So the thing is, these scooters now seem to be adding insult to injury. And a lot of the most creative vandalism against the scooters was in San Francisco. But there's some version of that same kind of battle in almost every city in the country where you have sort of more tech-savvy people, sometimes this is called tech arrogance, who seem to be taking over and competing with what had been there before. I mean, we saw this with Uber and Lyft coming along, too, which also seemed to serve a more exclusive population. And a lot of the biggest players in scooters came from or are connected with Uber and Lyft. So it's
and Silicon Valley.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Peter Norton is a historian of engineering and society at the University of Virginia. He's our guide. As a driver, what irritates you most about how we regulate where bikes and scooters can operate? As a pedestrian, do you feel like your stretch of sidewalk is encumbered, or do you think they're generally pedestrian-friendly, free of obstacles? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll get back after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about street design and the politics of prioritizing modes of transportation. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Some bicyclists may feel anxiety when sharing the road with cars, and now some pedestrians may feel anxiety to share the sidewalk with electric scooters. We're talking about the interplay here and the history that informs our transportation situation as we know it today. Wisconsin recently legalized electric scooters. How do you see transportation evolving where you live? Do you live in an area where you see lots of scooters or not a single one? What have they done for transportation options in your area? Join in 800-642-1234. Peter Norton stays with us. He's a historian of engineering and society teaching at the University of Virginia. Let's bring in a call now. Mike joining us from Wauwatosa. Hi, Mike.
Hi. So I think you'll always have pushback with any new technology. You had the horse and cart to carriages, then that was displaced by automobiles, then trolleys, trains, bicycles, motorcycles, the skateboards in the 80s, rollerblades, and now it's scooters. You know, I think people should just embrace it and just, you know, take it for what it is. And as my grandpa used to tell me, with any tool, when misused or misheld, any tool can become a weapon.
Mike, thank you so much. Peter Norton, this is natural evolution.
Oh, I think that's a very astute observation. I mean, there is resentment against anything that comes along that we're just not used to and that hasn't quite found where it will fit in yet. On the other hand, I do think that there's something very valuable about the pushback, because the pushback is part of what helps us figure out how to use the tool, as Mike's grandpa said, safely instead of as a weapon. So it's not like they are automatically going to work. It takes the pushback to help them find their niche. So, for example, when the scooters were being deployed, in the early deployments, some of the companies would just dump enormous quantities of them without enough of the people who come around at night to charge them, so they wouldn't be charged up in the morning and not useful. They would put too many in the wrong places. They had no means of encouraging the users to park them so that they don't obstruct other people. And for all of those reasons, some of the early deployments were just terrible and helped create some of the resentment. And then you have the pushback, and the pushback compels the companies to come up with things to do that make them fit better. So, for example, if you get a scooter now, it will tell you things to do and not to do. I think Lime asks you to, or requires you to take a picture of your parked scooter to show that it's parked in a way that won't be a nuisance to others. And some of the pushback also helps give us the rules that are necessary. Like, so in Denver, the initial rule was you had to ride your scooter on the sidewalk. And then the pushback was so intense that now Denver requires exactly the opposite. You have to ride your bike on the street.
Your scooter on the street.
Your scooter.
See, there you go.
But I just want to stress that it's really important to have that pushback. It's not just sort of resentment that's unproductive. It's very productive.
Let's bring in John now, calling from Boaz. Hi, John.
Hi. We need to go with the flow. Remember what they said when the automobile came out. Well, we can look to the future because the cost per mile is a big savings. We don't need to burn hydrocarbons to go to get a loaf of bread for 10 miles. I had, in the 60s, I was driving a Honda 50. In the owner's manual, it said it had 305 miles per gallon.
So, John, you think that scooters are perhaps better for our climate, that we should, you know, look to them as being healthier for our environment?
Absolutely.
Peter, what impact do you see on the climate with scooters?
So one of the strongest cards that the scooter companies play is they say that a scooter ride is often a trip that's made instead of a car trip. And that really would make a very big difference to the extent that that's true. And certainly it's true to some extent. It's not clear how many times a scooter trip is replacing a car trip. But we can actually kind of influence that number if we can make street space more inviting to scooter riders and cycle riders, and also provide better for pedestrians. Then we know that that's going to displace some driving, and if it can displace enough of it, then we can actually reassign some city street space and some road space so that we make cycling and scooter riding feel safer and more inviting. And then you get some really nice effects, like you'll find that populations of people who are more risk-averse will start riding bikes and riding scooters and walking as well. And that has wonderful public health effects. It makes better use of our space. And, yes, it's also a good way to reduce the energy demands for travel as well, which clearly we need to be doing.
So if on an average street in a medium city, 90% of the space designated for transportation is going for vehicles, is there room to reimagine there? Or are we really set up in our grids and in our way of approach to transportation that is going to favor vehicles for a long time to come?
Well, I think change is necessary and possible. There's some debate about what that change would look like. There's a lot of people who would like to see the change go more in the direction of keeping passenger cars on the road, but they would be automated more. With high technology, we could have people travel safer and more efficiently. The cars could be spaced closer together. But I think it would be much better to go forward with making it possible to not need to be in a car as much. We can still provide space for cars, but we can make more space for lots of other things, walking, cycling, transit like we've always known it, as well as innovative kinds of transit. And if we do that, we can make our cities more livable. We've learned that actually the walkable neighborhoods are the desirable places to live. That's what the real estate people are finding, that walkable downtowns have better retail business and attract companies. And ironically, walkable and also scooter-friendly go together. It seems like they don't go together right now because we're fighting over what's left over after that 90% that goes to cars. But if it was, say, 50% or 60% that goes to cars, we could have an environment where riding scooters and cycling and other things are much more inviting, and then we don't need to worry about whether the high technology can save us in the short term. We can still work on it, but there's things we can do now. The autonomous vehicle future is a long way away, but there's things we can start doing now. And yeah, the change will be difficult, but it can be phased in step by step in small increments. And I think people will find it mostly quite attractive.
We're looking at the evolution of transportation with Peter Norton as our guide. He's an associate professor of history in the Department of Engineering and Society at the University of Virginia. Your thoughts here as well. Are you willing to share the sidewalk with different forms of transportation, or should sidewalks be limited to walking? Scooter riders, what do you like most about this form of transportation? How do you think we'll see our transportation evolve in your community? 800-642-1234. Let's go back to the phones with Adam in Milwaukee. Hi, Adam.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question and a comment. My comment is, are they going to be paying road taxes to contribute to repairing the sidewalks or roads? And my comment is, I work for a company in Milwaukee, and we deliver to the Madison University every day. And a lot of kids have these scooters. And a lot of these kids are very reckless with the scooters. They could be riding on the sidewalk, jump onto the road, and they'll be coming at you or coming past you on the right. And it's many times become very dangerous for us to go out there. When they're going through classes, in between classes. My comment is about that is, do you think that they should get a special driver's license, a permit, to be well-informed on how to operate?
Adam, thanks so much for the call. Starting out with taxing scooters, we had an email as well about that from Eric in Pound, Wisconsin. What do we know about taxing small motorized scooters?
These are really great questions, and they are still evolving, and the answers are changing all the time. But what we've already seen is that cities are insisting that the scooter companies get permits and comply with evolving regulations, and the permits aren't free. The scooter companies have to pay a significant amount of money to operate at all, and then they also generally have to pay something for each scooter that they deploy. And that money does go to the municipality, and therefore you could say that the scooters are being taxed and the scooter riders paying that tax through the fee that you pay to ride the scooter. Now, the scooter tax is going to be a lot less than what you pay for gas taxes if you're driving your car. But on the other hand, if you're driving your car, you're using a lot more of that public street space and you're wearing out the street much more than a scooter ever could. So the tax picture is evolving, but yeah, scooter riders are paying something to the public for that access.
Talking with University of Virginia historian Peter Norton stays with us. He researches the historical influences of transportation in the Department of Engineering and Society. Do you live in an area where you see electric scooters? What is your biggest issue with them? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about sharing the road and how we go about doing that as we see more modes of transportation in our communities. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Peter Norton is our guide. He teaches at the University of Virginia, where he's a historian of engineering and society. Let's go back to the phones now with Joe joining us in Baraboo. Hi, Joe.
Hi, I just wanted to say, what about the possibility of using separate speed limits for the road versus the sidewalk for scooters? Because if you were in like a close-knit downtown area and coming out of a shop, I would hate for a guy clipping along at 20 miles an hour on a scooter to surprise you right on the sidewalk there. But if you had like a speed limit of, say, 5 miles an hour on the sidewalk and 25 on the street, they could keep up on the street, and it would be more likely that they would go there and also keep the sidewalk safe.
Joe, thanks for making that observation. Peter, can we, be that specific about speed?
Well, I think actually there's pretty good news there in the sense that while it would be very hard to enforce different speed limits in different zones, if you do ride a scooter on a sidewalk, it's likely that you're already in violation of the local or state ordinance. And yet, the thing is, you probably will not be cited or stopped for it unless you're being a hazard. And so, in effect, what Joe's proposing is almost there typically now anyway, in the sense that if you go 5 miles an hour on a scooter on a sidewalk, even for a mile, you probably won't be stopped by a police officer. But if you were to go 15 or 20 miles an hour, you actually quite possibly would be stopped for that.
Let's bring in Scott now in Wanakee. Hi, Scott.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good.
So my wife and I went to Fort Lauderdale this April, and they had actually a couple different brands of scooters around town. We found them quite convenient, especially in a tourist town like that, where you're going back and forth perhaps from your hotel to the beach. We were maybe a mile away from the strip and the beach, and get up in the morning and open the app, and, oh, we need a couple scooters. Oh, there's one. There's a couple right down the street, and hop on and go, and we get there, and $5 later, we were at the beach without having to worry about an Uber or, you know, I guess we walked sometimes, but sometimes just out of convenience, we took the scooters.
So, Scott, before you went to Florida, had you used them before?
No, I had not really even seen them before. I didn't know such a thing existed.
And how do you feel about them after this trip?
Oh, I thought they were great, and I was thinking about how they would do in Madison, for example. In Fort Lauderdale, like I said, a tourist community, they're great. You're going back and forth. But as far as, like, the roads versus the sidewalks, they recommended there that you use the sidewalks, and that was okay. Fort Lauderdale has pretty wide sidewalks, especially along the beach. But it seemed to me that it would make more sense that they should just go wherever bikes go, because it's kind of, you know, similar transportation mode. The rules should be the same. And as we increase our bike lanes and such in our communities, I think it just kind of is natural for them to go there.
Scott, thanks for those observations. And Peter, what impact might we see on tourism?
Well, scooters were really first deployed in large numbers, typically in tourist areas. Santa Monica was one of the leaders with Bird on that. And Fort Lauderdale as well. And Fort Lauderdale, as Scott said, actually required you to ride your scooter on its sidewalks. One of the three very serious cases of injury, I'm talking lethal or almost lethal, was in Fort Lauderdale, where a scooter rider was riding in the street in violation of Fort Lauderdale's rules. And the rider was seriously injured and is still in a coma. And yet, I think Scott's got a very good common sense view that's also becoming the prevalent view, which is that these are practically a lot like bicycles. They have the same kind of street profile in terms of the space they take up. And we, I think, in general, in our cities, could do a much better job finding room for that kind of vehicle in a way that won't be a nuisance or a danger to pedestrians, but will also be safe for the scooter rider. And I think that's increasingly going to mean something like bike lanes, and scooters will be expected to be there.
Let's bring in Mike now in Madison with thoughts on this. Hi, Mike.
Hi, I'd like the guest to comment on this. Emissions from scooter bikes and walking and biking, as far as that goes, it's a minuscule amount of greenhouse gases that are emitted to the atmosphere compared to travel by commuters to large cities everywhere in the world, thousands of miles for vacations to beaches in winter, and tens of thousands of miles by airplane trips to vacations, other countries, education, even protesting.
Mike, thanks for those observations. Peter, will we be able to learn more specifics in the future about emissions and scooters?
Well, there's pretty good information now on how much power they require, mm-hmm. and then depending on where the sources of the energy are for your grid, that can give you a pretty good idea of the carbon footprint of a scooter. It gets a little complicated because it depends a lot on whether the scooter ride is in addition to the demand or is actually replacing something else like a car drive, and that would have a big significance on the carbon footprint. But I do think it's very clear that we can say that the more scooter-friendly and bike-friendly a town or a city is, the better its total energy demand for transportation is going to be. Because too many of our cities in America, it's very hard to do anything except with a car. And the more we make it possible to do anything except driving, the better.
Benjamin from Green Bay called in, said, used to own a scooter with four wheels, used for medical reasons. And Benjamin says, was limited in where to take it, to drive it, because of lips on sidewalks and intersections. Also says drivers were cautious. And Ron from Oconto wonders about mobility scooters and how they're different than the electric scooters we're talking about.
Well, the issues for disability people with disabilities are huge. Thanks to the American with Disabilities Act of 1990, cities are supposed to have curb cuts so that the sidewalks can all be accessed. But a number of cities have had problems with so many scooters being discarded that they get in the way of those. And there have been some terrible cases of people whose mobility has been degraded by scooters left around. Now, there's been some interesting responses, including not just by the companies and by the city ordinances, but even just by citizens who have started to share pictures of badly parked scooters as a way to sort of publicize the issue. And also a lot of people just walking along, if they see a discarded scooter, will pick it up and move it out of the way. So, you know, people are inventive, and we're finding ways to diminish this problem, but there's a long way to go.
So as we wrap up here, when you look at the way we regulate and divide up our paths today, considering the clashes that we're seeing, is there room for improvement? Should we rethink the way we divvy up transportation space?
I think so. I think for reasons of climate change and energy consumption, as well as public health and livability and social equity, we could do a lot better than the status quo now, which is still mostly car dependency, not necessarily car preference, because sometimes people are driving when they would rather get around in some other way, but those other ways just don't have a fair chance. And if we can give people choices, let people drive if they feel they need to drive, but make it more inviting to do other things, including riding scooters, walking, and riding cycles, I think that would be good for everybody.
Peter, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Kate.
Peter Norton is an associate professor of history in the Department of Engineering and Society at the University of Virginia. Just ahead, a psychologist tells us what happens to our brains when we binge watch TV. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.